We've got Dave Kattenberg here in the studio with us. So, Dave, welcome to Radio Free World.
Yeah, hello, Michael. It's good to be here.
Okay, now, I've got this book in my hand. It's just released, I believe, a second edition.
Print on demand.
This is the
first edition of the book. It was formally released by the publisher in March, just at the end of March. But it's been out in print form and available since the end of 2010.
Right.
But it's just been published formally, released by the distributor.
Now, this is a story. It was about a Canadian, Stuart Glass, who was murdered on a yacht, which was by the Khmer Rouge, and it was the name of the yacht was Foxy Lady.
Yes.
And this was a yacht that the Stuart Glass met with another gentleman, a New Zealander.
Yeah, a Foxy Lady was a little traditional Malaysian double ender, a wooden yacht, small, 27 feet long, 28 feet long, owned by Stuart, the Canadian, and a New Zealander named Kerry Hamill.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of their voyage, they took the boat from Darwin, Australia, down to the Indonesian, along the Indonesian archipelago, and to Phuket and Thailand, and all around up and down the Straits of Malacca. And then in eastern Malaysia, they picked up a paying passenger, an Englishman named John Dewhurst, and took off on the final leg of their voyage and found themselves in Cambodian waters for reasons that are unclear, and were attacked by a patrol vessel of the Democratic Kampuchean Navy. Cambodia at that time was run by the Maoist Khmer Rouge, and they named Cambodia Democratic Kampuchea. So they were attacked. Stuart was killed on the boat, shot and killed or drowned. And Kerry Hamill, the New Zealander, and John Dewhurst, the Englishman, were taken to the notorious S-21 death house, where 14,000 Cambodians perished. The commandant was Doik, who's just been sentenced in Cambodia to 35 years in prison. And John and Kerry were forced to sign confessions that they were CIA agents, and they were tortured and finally killed. So Stuart, in a sense, was the lucky one because he got shot and killed.
Yeah. His yacht companions met a much more gruesome, a more gruesome fate.
Yes, they did.
Okay. So I was just, I've been through the book, and basically the way it's constructed, you seem to weave the autobiography, or the biography of this man, this Canadian,
very adventurous
Stuart Glass,
young man,
with the history of the Cambodia from of Kampuchea from the going back to mostly around the when it became independent, and then moving through to the rise of Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. And you talk a lot about this Doik. I'm not too sure about the pronunciation. That's, I guess, Doik is the way it's pronounced. But and it's interesting to see, because as you go from chapter to chapter, there's an interesting contrast. I find you're going from a sort of a formal reading through this historical background of the area, and then you go to this young man, Stuart Glass.
It's like two parallel universes, in a sense.
It's the
universe of Stuart Glass, the young adventurer from Richmond, British Columbia, traveling, living life to the fullest, often dangerously, smuggling drugs. Lives a while in England and smuggles hashish from North Africa, and travels down the hippie trail, and just going back and forth between the unfolding of Stuart's life and the rise of Democratic Kampuchea, the rise of the Khmer Rouge, which is largely a history of this sort of 30-year Indochina conflict. Once Democratic Kampuchea is formed, of course, the story kind of follows Doik, or Duk, who becomes the Khmer Rouge's chief executioner, and sort of follows the story of S21, Tool Slang, yeah. This death house in Phnom Penh. And the two stories run in parallel until finally they converge
at that moment on the Foxy Lady. Could you explain what it was that captivated you about this particular story, and particularly why your introduction? I mean, was it the fact that Stuart Glass was a Canadian, and it's like, what's this Canadian doing in this?
Yeah,
you know,
I visited,
what's a guy like you doing in this strange place?
I visited Tool Slang. The S21 is now called the Tool Slang Genocide mm-hmm. Museum. It's a former high school in Phnom Penh. And I visited it in 2007, and there are various rooms where you find photographs of, you know, thousands of Cambodians who perished there. And I found a photograph of a Westerner, who, and I was astonished. It was very ethnocentric, thinking, wow, this guy died here. So back in Winnipeg, I did a Google search, foreigners, Tool Slang, and I discovered that 8 Westerners had died. 4 Americans, 2 Aussies, and a New Zealander and an Englishman had died in S21. And the New Zealander and the Englishman had been traveling on a little yacht together with a Canadian. And I thought, that's amazing. I never knew that a Canadian had died in the Cambodian genocide. So his name was Stuart Glass, and I did a Google search. And to make a long story short, I realized that nothing was known about this guy other than the fact that he was named Stuart Glass, and he was a Canadian. So I was just mystified. I set out to try to find out who this guy was. And it didn't take me too long to find members of his family in Richmond, British Columbia. And so I the story goes on, trying to uncover the life and details of the life of Stuart Glass.
Yeah, and you discovered some interesting things. I mean, he was, as a young man, unusually large.
He was a very, very, very tall guy. He was about 6'7".
And you think that maybe that somehow shaped his destiny in a way?
Well, he was a funny guy. You know, I say in the book that he was kind of like a young adventurous man trapped in a difficult body, right? He was pigeon-chested and had surgery on his chest and had, through the course of his childhood and youth, all sorts of problems because he was very, very tall, very large. You know, he used to get into fights in bars because people thought he was the bouncer, and, you know, he used to be denied permission to get into movies as a youth because people thought he was like 18 or 19 years old when he was actually 14.
Wow.
So a tall guy, a big guy, big lovable guy. His friends called him the gentle giant.
Yeah. And, as he, soon after high school, he found himself traveling abroad back to, I guess his family originally came from the UK, am I correct?
Yeah, his family, his father had actually been born in Victoria, British Columbia, but then had gone back with his family to England, and mm-hmm. Stuart was born in the UK of British parents.
Now he got involved in some illicit activity. Now this is around in the late 60s, correct? 60s.
Well,
and
no,
70s?
He traveled to he left Richmond. BC traveled to England to live and work in the summer of 1972.
Yeah,
and found himself traveling to North Africa. And how this all happened and unfolded, it's not entirely clear. But he connected with individuals who had an interest in smuggling hashish back into England, and there were all sorts of young people and not so young people smuggling hash back and forth into England from North Africa and elsewhere, and Stu kind of was just enthralled by the possibilities and enjoyed them and had a great time.
He was a man of his times, would you say?
He was ahead of his time. He was so to speak, he was a young adventurer who enjoyed taking risks. And
You could maybe talk a little bit about the complexities of getting all of that that background information on
lots of research,
this.
lots of digging, I mean, lots of phone calling.
Yeah, like we have to clarify. Like, I mean, this, like, until you came along, like, hardly anybody knew anything about this man. I mean, this
no,
is
nothing,
all...
zero. you know, and speaking with people who knew, who had heard about Foxy Lady and a little bit about the background of the other yachtsmen who had been seized, because like a total of four yachts with nine yachtsmen were seized, and several of these yachts were. One of them was almost certainly transporting Thai sticks, Thai marijuana,
mm-hmm.
When it was seized by the Khmer Rouge in Cambodian waters. And there was a bit of a rumor around that I picked up pretty early that Foxy Lady was transporting Thai sticks, transporting Thai marijuana, or okay. was perhaps on its way to Bangkok to pick up Thai marijuana. And so when I found out that Stewart actually had been busted in the UK for smuggling cannabis resin, hashish, into the UK. When I found that out and thus realized that he had a history of this sort of activity, I thought, So I just dug and dug, and, you know, it takes a lot of phone calls, takes a lot of digging, and I got a hold of his, you know, the indictment papers from the UK Ministry of Justice and information about his trial and imprisonment. And I mean, I tracked down his former girlfriend, his former wife, because the two got married in Australia. I tracked her down, and she corroborated, filled in much of the story that is sort of told in this book.
Yeah.
So it takes...
It's a major piece of the puzzle, it would seem to me.
It takes a lot of persistence, lots of phone calling, emailing, and kind of a...
So
a bit of an obsessive personality.
Yeah. Now, like I say, you weave that story in with the story of the rise of the Khmer Rouge, and I guess one of the things that struck me reading through it is this fellow Stuart Glass. That was somebody like, I mean, he had his unusual traits to him, but he was still a very recognizable human being. Someone I could kind of relate to. And then you have this regime and the people that were, when you said that whole rise of the Khmer Rouge, especially, you know, throughout the 1970s, and how people were mobilized. I mean, the mobilization of young people around this class dynamic, as I think you explain it. And I guess I found that, like, there you're moving back and forth. Here's a guy I can kind of relate to, and here's a situation which I can maybe understand academically, but to understand the psychology of the people, it takes. And I'm not saying that that's necessarily, you know, something that you're it was like any kind of a failure on your part, but you're trying to approach a culture that's foreign and alien.
Although I talk a lot about Doik, who is a little bit of a counter-hero, is not the right word, but Doik, you know, the human characteristics of this guy who was the Khmer Rouge's chief executioner, the commandant of S-21. You know, in the course of investigating his life and his activities, you know, his person, and attending his trial in Phnom Penh, I attended part of his trial.
Yes.
You know, this guy comes across as a human being who's conflicted and who's driven by, these human senses, these human emotions, the desire to be successful, the desire to be accepted, the desire to be, the imperative to be loyal, trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's funnily enough.
There's even a photo in the book where you see him kind of breaking down at the stand there.
Yes. Yeah. So I, you know, of all the Khmer Rouge characters in the book, the one who emerges as the most human, somebody who's three-dimensional, is Doik. The other ones, of course, are mentioned, but I don't explore their personalities in any way that would suggest that there's something compelling about their personalities like there is with Doik.
Yeah. Well, when you look at that, like, you're humanizing this Doik character, but then you describe the S-21 and that prison. I mean, could you just, you know, give our listeners a sense of what the kinds of things that went on there?
Well, it was referred to by one journalist as the Auschwitz of Southeast Asia. It was a former high school where the classrooms had been turned into torture cells. And one entered S21 already having been considered guilty. Otherwise, one wouldn't have entered to begin with. It was the psychology of those who ran S21. And the frightful, you know, 14,000 people died there. There was a whole district of Phnom Penh, sort of, that comprised S21. The inner core was the high school, with walls and barbed wire around it. But outside of that were, sort of, it was a whole district of houses where people were tortured, where torturers lived. It was a horrible place to find oneself.
Mm-hmm.
And one can only imagine what the eight Westerners who lived and died there over the course of a couple of months between April 1978 and November 1978, when these eight guys were dragged in there. You know, it's a frightful thought to think that, you know, an adventure trip of a lifetime ends up in that way. Yeah. I don't want to give too much away, and much of this information is very graphic. It's not really entirely suitable to talk about over the radio, and it's difficult, but suffice to say that it was a death house.
Yeah.
Doik himself referred to it as a death house.
Is there anything over the course of researching this? It was a 2-year project or more?
Yeah, I was researching it for 2 years. Two years. It took me about a year to write the book. So, but I over that last year, I was doing research as well. So it's 3 years of research.
Yeah. Unfortunately, our society's become aware of all of these gruesome, you know, genocides and mass killings that have taken place. The real man's inhumanity to man, like, since, you know, going back, you know, 40, 50 years. And so I'm wondering if over the course of doing the research and writing the book, if you've maybe gleaned a better understanding of not only the Cambodian situation, but anything that can translate to an understanding of some of the other mass killings, Rwanda, for example, or Darfur, or some of the other trouble spots, anything about the psychology that may have been impressed on you that these things can happen?
Well,
or is this sort of like unique to the Cambodian?
Well, I suppose all acts of or episodes of genocide, mass murder involve the activities of individuals, a small circle of individuals who obsessively believe in something, who have an ideology that is entirely closed to humanistic reason.
Yeah.
And people who are totally fixed on an idea, and in the case of the Khmer Rouge, this idea that they could achieve some monumental leap forward economically and, you know, sociologically, economically, politically, within 5 years, within a very short period of time, they could totally transform a society and in ways that no one had ever accomplished before. Almost a kind of a dystopian view of society.
When you set out to write a book like this and do an investigative piece on this scale, I'm wondering if there aren't any hazards in terms of, you know, like getting the characters right. I mean, you're talking about somebody that's long gone, and then there are all these different, like, the family members and friends and acquaintances that are still alive. Is there any danger? Because, I mean, I could see where there's a, you're talking about this historical event, which has a certain, you know, significance in our minds. And, I mean, you would remember those times. And I'm wondering if, you know, there's a danger of slipping into stereotypes and not necessarily, you know, trying to grasp the essence, the complexity of these individuals. Is that something that that is a challenge for you? Or,
well, in the case of Stuart Glass, I wanted to be able to portray him in an honest way, portray him in a way that his family would be able to, and his friends would be able to read this book and say, yeah, that was Stuart. So I spent lots of time interviewing his family and his friends and his former partner, and actually exchanged versions of the manuscript with his former partner so that she could go over it and make sure the facts were right and Stuart had been portrayed correctly. You know, I'm more concerned about that, portraying Stuart in a way that's true to Stuart, and his mother could read the book and say this was Stuart, than, you know, fairly portraying Doik. I mean, based on all I've based my portrayal of Doik on was the 6 weeks in which I spent watching him in court and my viewing of the videos of his trial, you know, those sessions of his trial that I wasn't able to attend, and my readings of the transcripts. And so, you know, I'm not trying to, I don't pretend to present a completely accurate psychological profile of Doik. Others have attempted that, and you know, who knows? One needs to spend a lot of time with a person like that. But as far as Stuart is concerned, spending lots of time with his friends and family and trying to get his personality straight.
Yeah, and like with the visits and the interviews. I'm thinking particularly the S21 prison, but I don't know. Were there any other encounters that you had that maybe really made an impression on you that helped?
Well, in the course of my research in Cambodia, I had the chance to interview former S21 guards, and I interviewed the former chief of the Khmer Rouge Democratic Kampuchean Navy, Mias Moot, who the Khmer Rouge Tribunal in Phnom Penh has been investigating the possibility of charging Mias Moot. It seems as if he won't in the end be charged. But I interviewed him, spoke with him, just once. One gets glimpses of people's personalities, but it's fascinating to track people down and speak with them and find them. I don't pretend to be able to convey in my book the full personality and careers of these individuals, but having met them and spoken with them briefly was one of the most interesting elements or facets of producing this book.
Yeah. So what are you, just in the last couple of minutes remaining, what are you hoping that people, when they read the book, that they will end up coming away with? Are you... maybe a sort of a different take on a historical event, or maybe some more.
I want them to know who Stuart Glass was, because for 33 years, all that we've known here in Canada or elsewhere about Stuart Glass was that he existed, his name and his nationality. And really, Canadians have never heard anything about Stuart Glass, his existence, his travels, his sense of adventure, his life, his death. No one's. He died anonymously, and I want Canadians to know who he was and to know he existed and to have a sense of him and who he was and to take pleasure in reading about his life and to think about him a little bit, because he was a good guy. He was a sweet young man, and it would be wonderful if Canadians kind of learned a little bit about what happened in Cambodia between April 1975 and January of 1979. You know, 2 million, between 1.7 and 2.2 million Cambodians died in this genocide. It was the second greatest genocide of the 20th century. And you know, it's lost to memory, just like Stuart Glass. People don't know that this happened anymore.
Yeah.
People have only the vaguest of senses of what happened in Cambodia.
Yeah, sometimes it seems like our sense of outrage only goes back as far as 9/11.
yeah. But aside from that, I think it's an adventurous read. It's an intriguing read. It's the first time the yachtsman's story has been told in a devoted way, and it's I think a story that people who enjoy travel, adventure travel, who've ever sailed on a boat, people who've ever traveled through Europe or down the hippie trail, people who've ever taken risks in their lives and were lucky enough to have emerged unscathed. Anybody who's, with a sense of history would enjoy reading this book.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, I've picked it up recently, and I haven't made my way through the whole thing, but it's certainly, I found it a very engaging read so far.
And we should tell people where to buy a copy.
Yeah.
Foxy Lady can be purchased at McNally Robinson at Grant Park, and it's also available at Custom Culture in Osborne Village and at Mondragon's, Mondragon Bookstore.
Okay, so
and also at the U of M bookstore, the University of Manitoba bookstore has copies as
okay,
well.
Okay, great. Okay, so it's on the bookstores now, just in time for Mother's Day. Hint, hint. And so I want to thank you for coming on the show and telling us about your book. It's been quite a treat to have you here, Dave Kattenberg.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Okay, that's Dave Kattenberg, author of Foxy Lady: Truth, Memory, and the Death of Western Yachtsmen in Democratic Kampuchea. Of course, Dave Kattenberg is also the producer of The Green Planet Monitor, which we also air here on CKUW, and is also a frequent contributor to Dispatches, as well as having contributed to documentaries to Free Speech Radio and Radio Netherlands. So, we're just going to go shortly to the news, so we'll be back in just a second. Thank you.